Welcome to Beekeeping Today Podcast, presented by Bee Culture. Beekeeping Today Podcast is your source for beekeeping news, information, and entertainment. I'm Jeff Ott.
And I'm Kim Flatham.
Hey, Jeff and Kim. Today's sponsor is Global Patties. They're a family-operated business that manufactures protein supplement patties for honeybees. It's a good time to think about honeybee nutrition. Feeding your hive's protein supplement patties will ensure that they produce strong and healthy colonies by increasing brood production and overall honey flow. Now is a great time to consider what type of patty is right for your area and your honeybees. Global offers a variety of standard patties as well as custom patties to meet your needs. No matter where you are, Global is ready to serve you out of their manufacturing plants in Airdrie, Alberta, and in Butte, Montana, or from distribution depots across the continent. Visit them today at www.globalpatties.com.
Hey, thanks for that, Sherry. We really appreciate our sponsors. You know, without their support, we would have a very difficult time bringing you this podcast on a weekly basis. With that, thanks to Bee Culture Magazine for continuing their presenting sponsorship of this podcast. Bee Culture has been the magazine for American beekeeping since 1873. Also, check out Bee Culture's Beekeeping Your First 3 Years, a quarterly magazine for beginning beekeepers. We also want to thank 2 Million Blossoms as sponsor of this episode. 2 Million Blossoms is a quarterly magazine dedicated to protecting all pollinator insects. Learn more on our Season 2, Episode 9 podcast with editor and our guest co-host, Kirsten Trainer, and from visiting their website, www.2millionblossoms.com, and that is with the number 2. Hey, everybody, thanks for joining us. Hey, Kim, welcome back. How's it going?
Yeah, it's going good. Fall is here, and suddenly things got real busy, and I got tied up and didn't expect to, but now I'm back, and I've only missed one, Jeff.
Well, that's good. One in 2.5 years. That's a pretty good record, Kim. I appreciate it. Thanks. Hey, we've had some excitement up here in Washington to break up the COVID and the election madness. They trapped and tagged an Asian giant hornet north of Seattle.
Well, I heard that they trapped one, and tagged it, but they lost it, right?
Yeah, they followed it for a little bit, and then it disappeared. So they're
suddenly that's got to be humbling.
Oh, you know, yeah. In our show notes, we'll provide a link to the Washington State Department of Agriculture's website for the Asian giant hornet, so folks can go out and look at it, and encourage everyone to go out to our Season 2, Episode 3, and that's from April this year, episode with Sven Spiesiker, who was the entomologist who's been involved in tracking the Asian giant hornet and involved in a press conference this week. And it's also a very good episode people might want to check out to get the facts about the Asian giant hornet.
Yeah, the facts, not the murder hornet.
Yeah,
the facts.
Yeah, you won't hear that term used from Sven. So, hey Kim, tell us about this week's guest. You're bringing back someone from our first season, episode 16, from November of 2018.
Yeah, back at that show, we talked with Marina Marchese, and yeah, she was the co-author of the book that we did together, The Honey Connoisseur. And we just kind of talked about the art of honey tasting. And this time, she has taken the American, since then, she has formed the American Honey Tasting Society. And she has brought what she learned in Italy over to the U.S. So now you can take honey tasting tests, do honey tasting in the U.S. and learn how to do it as an art form and as essentially as a science. The bummer, if you will, this year is that she's going to have to do one virtually, but she's putting together the package and everybody will have one, and it's supposed to work well. But she brought with her this time her mentor from Italy, Raffaele, and they're going to tell us about the basics of honey tasting again and what can go wrong. Listen in. You'll like what you hear, I think, Jeff.
All right, Lavelle, let's cue it up.
Well, Marina, it's good to see you again. It's been too long. How have you been?
I'm great. Thank you for having me again. I can't believe it's already a year and a half. I thought it was last fall.
Well, Marina, you and I were just talking, and you said that you were going to have your class again this fall, and my curiosity got the best of me, and I wanted to talk to you again about your class and the people who run the class in Italy. So We have Raphael today. You were kind enough to invite him over. And so, first off, tell me what it's like to go to Italy and be a student in this class, and then we'll have Raphael tell us about the school.
So, basically, I went to the first class. It's a three-part course. And the first class I took was back in 2013. And I ended up taking the class in Sardinia, which is an island off of Italy. And Raffaele was actually my first teacher. So we had been communicating, I think, on LinkedIn, and I was following what they were doing, but it was quite difficult for me to find the correct time and date for me to attend the class. But he emailed me, sent me a message and told me about a class. So I had enough time to actually get myself together, get on an airplane and find this class down in a little remote town in Sardinia. So it was actually everything that I was looking for. I was seeking information about honey and actually matching the flowers to the flavors. And, you know, we have all these wonderful honeys that are produced in the US, buckwheat, orange, clover, and many other wildflowers, but there's no resource or database or information to help us to understand them, to identify them, and even to be able to just talk about them with adjectives and descriptors besides saying, well, this honey is really yummy or delicious. So the first course that I took was 4 days. And it was very intense. There was a lot of information, a lot of theory, a lot of PowerPoints, and of course, a lot of honey tasting. And we learned about the floral sources. We learned about the flavors. We tasted. We learned a lot about how we taste as humans, how humans perceive taste and flavor. And basically, it was really what I was looking for, everything that I was thinking.
Well, you know, Marina, what you just mentioned, it was one of the reasons we got together back here a little while ago. You were talking about the flavors of honey and wanted to know more about the plants that were producing the honeys that are available. I got a background in plants, so we put our heads together, and that's where the Honey Connoisseur book came out, all about the plants and all about the honeys that those plants produce. So that's where that came from. And I still use it. I'm still able to use it. We're going to talk a little bit about something in a minute that came out of that book. But hold that thought. Raffaele, I guess tell us a little bit about yourself and your school. Who are you? What do you do? How did your school get started? How does it work?
Hi, Kim. Thank you for inviting me, first of all. And I am based in Bologna, in Italy. I am a biologist as a background. So actually, my background is as a researcher in honeybee science. I spent 12 hours at the National Institute of Beekeeping in Bologna, studying mainly characterization of bee genetics and pathogen diagnostic through molecular tools. But then I decided that I needed to be more in touch with the beekeepers. And so my institute was also providing this kind of teaching for beekeepers and also for consumers related to honey tasting. So I decided to be a student at first and then to become a teacher in order to stay in touch and also to improve my sensory skills. So this is how I started. And from 2006 to date, I've run several classes in Italy and lately also abroad, because we decided also to provide the classes in English starting from 2016. So for me, it was really, really useful to get some knowledge about beekeeping. I was not a beekeeper since 2005. And also to get some feedback and useful tips for my research. So some new idea, something to explore, and to have some applied research. But you know, I live in Italy. I love good food, and so it was almost natural for me to keep on going with the honey tasting. And actually, I think that honey is a very, very, it's a very easy food to learn and very also complex to describe. So it's a good food if you want to have a sensory class of any kind. I think honey is a great example for that. You have a lot of varieties. In Italy, we are so lucky. We live in a Mediterranean country, so we have a different flora from the Alps to Sicily. We have a potential to produce more than 20 single varieties of honey every year.
Wow. Well, in working with Marina, one of the things that I've discovered is that the skills that you used to learn to taste honey are somewhat similar to the skills that you use in learning to taste wine. Am I close there?
Yes, you are quite correct. In wine, you have the warmth of alcohol as a background. In honey, you have the sweetness of sugars as a background. So you need a little bit to get used to that in order to appreciate all of the aromas and odors that you can detect behind the sweetness. And I think that we also have some not too sweet and even some bitter honey to shock also consumer that sometimes say, oh, no, this is not for me. I don't like honey because it's just sweet. So we have also some very peculiar honey to make people understand what a great difference you can find between one floral source and another.
Jeff, have you ever done any honey tasting? Organized, I guess.
Yeah, I was going to say organized or otherwise.
Yeah.
Only the unofficial around the table tasting. I've not done any official tasting.
That's good enough. I mean, that's good enough. Yeah. If you have some fun.
Yeah.
If you have some fun in doing that, this is a very good start.
Yeah.
Moreover, what I can tell you, the class we provide, as Marina just said, it's a mix between tasting and lectures. And basically, I think that every beekeeper should attend this class because we go through the pipeline from the apiary location, from the equipment, down to the bottling and storage. And we stress every little step that can interfere with honey quality. Mm. So it's not a beekeeping class, but it's providing you a lot of good information to become a good beekeeper. Of course, with respect to our beekeeping, because I know that in US beekeeping is mainly focused on pollination, so it might be something different. But with a certain extent, I think also honey, it's a good income for beekeepers.
Well, I think for many beekeepers, especially small scale beekeepers and the backyard beekeepers, they are working in small batch environments, which I think really lends itself to honey tasting competitions. And also the ability to be able to sort their frames of honey and extract them based on floral sources or time of year or color, which would all lend itself, I would believe, to honey tasting competitions.
Mm-hmm. What we witness in the last 20 years, this competition led to a great increase in honey quality. Because at the beginning, everybody was convinced that his honey was the best in the world. But then when we started comparing each other and they realized that their neighbor were able to do something better, it was a challenge, a positive challenge for everybody. And so in the latest year, we have a very high quality honey attending our competition.
Very nice.
Well, I guess that you kind of answered it, but it does beg the question of why should I, why should I learn to taste honey like I learned to taste wine? I mean, I know a good honey when I taste it, and I know you've got a vocabulary that's astounding to describe the flavors of honey. Can you talk about that a little bit? Some of the terms you use to describe the flavor.
Mm-hmm. I can start, and maybe Marina, you can add something later, because as you know, the background of vocabulary and also our olfactory memory is related to our tradition and childhood. So it's very different from country to country, actually. So we might change some terminology with respect to where we are teaching because the references are different. But basically, yes, we use a wide range of vocabulary from the floral range, but not many honeys are floral, from the fruity, warmth, chemical, or spoiled. So we have a lot of descriptors, general, as a main family, and then we go down to peculiar descriptor in order to make easier for people to understand. But we try to teach a technique. We don't try to teach you how the honey should taste like. We try to teach you a technique in order for you to be able to apply that technique to your own production or to your local floral sources. So this is, I think, the main reason why everybody should get some training or a complete class in the sense on his sensory in order to be able to understand the technique and then to apply to his own production.
Not only do we teach in the class how to taste and identify quality honey and describe it, but also defects in honey, things that happen along the way from the hive to the bottle. So this was the part about the pipeline, meaning harvesting techniques, techniques beekeepers use to extract or store their honey, so best conditions for storing. So along the way, there's different things that could go wrong that will end up in the honey, you know, smells and flavors that shouldn't be there. And by teaching beekeepers how to identify those defects, there's also a back end in how to correct them. So again, making beekeepers produce a high quality product.
Okay. What can go wrong?
What can go wrong with honey?
I can tell you that one.
I can tell you a lot of stories about that. So first of all, you can choose the wrong location where to place your apiaries. I'm teaching a young beekeeper, so a teenager right now, and she lives very close to a sweet factory. So this spring, he was so happy to having his first harvest of honey. And then I ended up in having in my hands blue and green combs. And so we were investigating where this honey were coming from. And it was spring. So a lot of blooming was around us. But then we realized that just 1 kilometer away, there was a factory with some spillover of sweet syrups, and bees were taking advantage of that. So this is an example of something that can go wrong, actually.
And then, you know, things like the beekeeper uses too much smoke and the smoke gets absorbed into the wax and the honey. Then there's things like using
moisture control. Yeah. Moisture control for fermentation, for instance, can go wrong.
Thymol, overusing and misusing varroa treatments. So that could end up in the honey. There's a whole array of problems that can happen.
A lot of beekeepers are convinced that you have to harvest honey when the comb is fully kept because honey is correctly ripened. Normally, this is the truth, but the real truth is that the honeybees, they close the cap when the cell is full. So sometime it might be that there are environmental conditions not enabling the bees to correctly ripen the honeys.
That's a good question on moisture and honey. You were right, and you're told when you start beekeeping that don't harvest a comb unless it's at least 80% capped. But what you're saying is that sometimes you can have a comb that's not or a frame that's not even half cap, but yet the honey is ripe?
Yes, that might be. For instance, this time of the year, normally during August, in Italy, we have eucalyptus blooming. Eucalyptus is normally in quite dry areas, and we have now 40 Celsius around with strong wind from south, very dry. So bees sometimes have to collect water in order to be able to harvest nectar as well. So they have to add some moisture. So sometimes you can have uncapped combs with a very dry honey. And in other circumstances, you can have it the other way around. For instance, early spring or late fall harvest, when the relative humidity of the environment is high, bees cannot properly remove moisture. So they keep on ventilating air from the outside inside the hives, but they just pump in some moisture from the outside. So they cannot find the correct equilibrium between the moisture in honey and the relative moisture in the atmosphere.
I guess the old proverb of test, the moisture content stands up then, no matter what it looks like when you harvest it, test, so that you don't harvest wet honey, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, you're right. Honey is like a sponge, so it keeps exchanging moisture with the environment also after the extraction. So if you leave, let's say, unattended supers, unkept combs, or maybe post-extraction you have exposure to moisture, honey can still absorb moisture from the environment. So you have to keep on testing for moisture until you bottle it.
Once you extract the honey, what's the best way? Is there a preference in terms of how to storage in the States? Many beekeepers will store, at least backyard beekeepers, will store their honey in 5-gallon pails or larger. For competition and for honey tasting, do you recommend a specific size of container to store your honey?
Well, this depends from the organizers of the competition. Mm-hmm. So they normally ask for a standard, let's say, or just a single size jar in order to make the entries anonymous. So they don't want labels. They want the same kind of jar in order mm-hmm. to make everything anonymous from the beginning. But for storage, I would say glass is the best to store honey long term. If you have to store it in larger container like pails or drums, this is okay. But you have to pay attention to keep it also in a chilled environment, not to warm them. Because even if you use food grade plastic, that means that this is not harmful for the consumer, but some flavor, if you expose them at the warm temperature, they can be released from the plastic. And the same is for the drums. Normally, drums are painted inside, and this paint is protecting them from corrosion. But, you know, those kind of drums are also recycled several times. Sometimes they get bumped. They have some cracks inside, and honey is very corrosive. So you can get some metal taste from long storage in the drum. Mm. Best for honey is to stay in the dark, some sterile environment. Not sterile is not the right English terminology. Let's say like glass, so with or stainless steel, for instance. Possibly, let's say, below 20 degrees Celsius, from 4 to 20 degrees Celsius, this is a good range to store honey properly to avoid aging.
You know, Jeff, we just recently talked to Jay Evans, and he was talking, remember him talking about funky honey?
Yeah, yeah.
And it turns out that it had how long it was stored. So is there a time frame of storing honey that I need to pay attention to?
Again, so this is going down to the regulation. Because, you know, we think about honey as the food for the bees, but actually honey is a legal definition of a food. So every country you go, honey has a different definition. We have the honey law in Europe, which sets some parameters, but in US you have a different law. So I would say until you stay into the parameters that are set to the law, from the law, you are in the right position. But then if you ask me, what should I do to preserve honey at its best, and how long can I keep the honey in order to appreciate its properties from a nutritional perspective and also from an organoleptic perspective, I would say the sooner the better. So the best moment to consume honey is as in the comb, let's say, before extraction. That's the best way to consume honey.
So you probably shouldn't enter the honey from the Egyptian pharaohs into a honey tasting contest, is what you're saying.
No, that would be okay to eat, no harm for the consumer, but it won't be much
taste
delightful.
Marina, you mentioned earlier about crystallization. Does that do anything to the flavor?
Well, crystallization, one of the things that I found so interesting in the class is that There are many different kinds of quality of crystallization. I mean, people talk about, oh, it's crystallized, it's fine. But one of the things that I learned is that the quality of the crystals really matter. And there's different kinds of defects, so to speak, of crystallization. Generally, if it's homogenized and it's all even, it's fine. But sometimes honey that's overheated or exposed to moisture will separate and do different things, like sort of layer, and also kind of, it looks like a foam, like incomplete crystallization, and different kinds of faults or defects. So I think it's interesting to teach about crystallization, because there's so many different factors that go into it. And I think the quality of the crystals really matter, and that's important for beekeepers to learn.
Well, when I'm making crystallized honey, creamed honey, I always begin by having a starter, what we call a starter. And that's a very, very, very fine crystals that I mix in, so that the crystals that form using those as the nucleus of crystals are also very, very small. So if I had a bigger crystal, is that going to affect the flavor?
I definitely will affect the sensory qualities. In the class, when we teach, we have every honey sample is presented as a liquid and also in its crystallized form. So there's different qualities to it. I mean, I think the flavor is basically the same. Raphael, would you chime in on that? But I think the perception of the texture and also certain qualities would change when it's crystallized, but essentially the flavor is pretty much the same.
Well, there might be some small differences with respect to the size and shape of crystal, and but more important with respect to the solubility of the crystals. Because, you know, if you have a very soluble crystal, a very thin one that you can melt very quickly, this reaction in your mouth is also producing a refreshing sensation. While if you have a very hard to solve crystal, a large one, maybe you have to chew it, you get the opposite. You get a kind of warmth sensation. So actually, yes, I think crystallization matters. And to answer you, I can tell you, we normally do an exercise doing our classes, and we provide five different honey samples with five different textures. And we ask the students to evaluate them only with respect to the visual, if they like it or not, and with respect to the texture, not paying attention to the odor and flavor. And I did the same this year in Apimondia in Montreal with a group of 100 people. So actually I got some consistent number out of it. And, you know, we get some answer. Let's say sample one, it was scoring very, very good. Sample two, very bad. Sample three, average. Sample four, optimal. Let's say, so a large spectrum of difference. And everybody is amazed when I show them that it is the same honey sample that we managed to crystallize in five different ways. And the answers are so different. And also their perception of the flavor was different in that.
That's interesting. Wow. I would have not thought about that. And from a beekeeper's perspective, selling honey, that could be advantageous or very unadvantageous, depending on how it worked.
Yeah, absolutely. You need to know your target market, because some people like to have coarse crystals because they think about an artisanal product. They don't like the thin one because it's more, let's say, industrial. But for other consumers, they prefer to have this creamed honey because it's more spreadable, user-friendly, and also it is enhancing the aromas.
User-friendly is an interesting term. It doesn't drip off your toast.
Exactly, exactly.
Hello, beekeepers. Your honeybees face a lot of challenges out there. Unbalanced food sources from monoculture crops, holding yards, drought, food shortages, antibiotics, pesticides, and pathogens like chalkbrood. To overcome these challenges, your bees need the multiple bacteria that are in all nectars, pollens, and the environment. These bacteria aid honeybees' digestion and improve your honeybees' response and resilience to pesticides. Now you can help improve your honey colony health with a quick, easy, and safe-to-use product. Strong Microbials Super DFM Honeybee uses naturally occurring bacteria to restore the healthy gut biome of your honeybees. Check them out today at www.strongmicrobials.com.
Well, I want to learn how to taste honey. So in 5 minutes or less, if you can, what's the process? How do I do this? And what's it going to, what's each stage going to tell me? Is that possible to talk about that?
Marina, you want to answer this?
So yeah, in a nutshell, I thought for me personally, when I first started taking the classes, I think it was really helpful for me to understand the difference between taste and flavor. So taste being the five, sweet, sour, salt, and bitter, and umami on your tongue. And then being able to separate the flavors in your brain. So, tasting the honeys and then having, smelling them, and then being able to separate the difference between like a floral and a woody and understanding all of the different adjectives to describe honey. That was really helpful because when you put honey in your mouth, most of the time it's sweet, and then you have to dig deeper and you have to understand what are you tasting and then use your memories and use all of these adjectives to describe them. So that was really helpful to me. And we do an exercise in class where we have a little jar with a sweet substance in it with some, I shouldn't say it, but cinnamon. And we let the students taste it with their nose closed. And what they initially get is just something sweet. But when they open up their nose, then they can actually experience the flavor. Because we actually, humans experience flavor with our noses, and with a stuffy nose, you can't really taste honey or you can't taste any foods. So I think for me, the psychology of that really helped me, but also the other exercises that we do in class with the students of just letting them smell different standard odors. And then they have to identify them or describe them. And this really helps them build up the vocabulary and to memorize, pull out from their own personal memories, descriptors to describe the honey. So I think working like in the classroom setting and going through these exercises is really helpful to understand the method of that we train.
Marina, can you right now just do for our listeners who are sitting there and if they have a jar of honey, can you just step them through real quickly how they should taste that to understand the process as opposed to putting it on a piece of toast with butter on it? Can you step them through? So listeners, if you're sitting at home,
I have a honey.
There you go. So listeners, grab your favorite jar of honey.
Yeah. So grab your favorite jar of honey. And we really suggest that when you're tasting honey, that you put it in some kind of a glass container, rounded, so that when you do the smell part, you can really get your nose in there and move those molecules around.
And that looks like a red wine glass that you have there.
So you can grab like a red wine glass, or if you have a tumbler, small tumbler. And it's really impossible to smell honey out of the jar because you can't get your nose surrounded by the molecules. So basically, when we do an evaluation, we're looking at state, the aspect, is the honey liquid or crystallized? So that's usually the first step. And then we evaluate the color. We talk about any other aspects of the honey, whether there's foam in it or any bubbles, foreign particles. And then we take notes as we go through the evaluation. The second part is the smell test, and we'll need a spoon for that.
Before you go to the smell test, about how much honey do you put in your jar, in your glass? You have there about a quarter cup?
About 2 teaspoons.
Okay.
We put, I might have
a, I was close.
I have a little bit more in here, but.
Okay.
So what we like to do is we use basically a spoon, a plastic spoon. Metal's not so great because it could affect your ability to taste. We don't usually use wood. Definitely not a half of a coffee stir or a plastic straw. It's really nice to use a spoon. So what we do for the smell evaluation is we smear the honey around the sides of the glass. Don't worry about making it look messy. And then we stick our nose in there. And the first thing that we do is evaluate the intensity of the smell. And usually in the classroom, when the students have no references to be able to compare it to, we walk them through what the intensity, so it can be either a very light or delicate intensity, or even non-existent. There's no smell, or it can be super intense. And this one is actually, I would say, medium to intense. And then the next step is usually to describe what you're smelling, and you can use the honey wheel from that, or you can even just use your own memory. Your scent memories that you've pulled from your brain. And for this one is a very floral honey, and I get sort of notes of butterscotch, which might give it away, but I get a lot of sort of confectionery, like sweet. I know honey is sweet, but I get a very warm kind of confectionery note from this one. And then the last evaluation is the taste. So with the spoon, you'll put it on your tongue, let it melt a little bit, let the heat of your body spread it around your tongue, because we have...
I want to interrupt you here for a second, Marina, because when you say put it on your tongue, the front, middle, or back of your tongue? Yeah.
So I would put it on the middle of my tongue, but I would let it spread around, because we have taste buds all over our tongue. We also have them on the side of our mouth and on our top of our soft palate, even some down our throat. So I think it's really important to add some saliva to it and then actually just let it melt all over your mouth, because our tongue is where we're going to start perceiving things like the sour notes or the bitter notes, salty, if the honey happens to be salty. So that's the part of the tongue where you're going to gather that information. And then when you breathe, those molecules are going to go up your back of your throat, up to your nose, and reach your olfactory bulb and translate those molecules into flavors in our brain. And that's where we have to try to describe what we're tasting.
One of the things that I want to go back when you said one of the memories you have when you smell this is it floral. And am I correct in assuming that a rose has a very floral aroma, correct?
Yeah, rose. So there's many different kinds of florals. There's lilac, there's honeysuckle. So, you know, when you're tasting many different honeys from different sources, you may come across a rose or a lilac or a honeysuckle. So, you know, floral is what we would call a general flavor family. And then you can break it down into trying to describe perhaps the type of floral, or whether it's a dry floral or it's a fresh floral, or even the stem of a flower or the leaf of a flower.
What is interesting here is that not many honey bring the odors of their flowers, so not from the plants they come from. So it's not so likely. Very few honeys you can find the smell of the plant.
Hmm. So I get a floral, and what's something that isn't floral? What's another thing that I can smell somewhere else that I can also smell when I'm smelling my honey. What's another descriptor?
Well, there's the 9 flavor families that we use. So fruity, floral, woody, vegetal.
What's something that I would smell that would be vegetative?
Hay, for instance.
Okay. All right. Yes. All right.
The green tea. If you smell the tea bag, this is an example of dry vegetal.
Okay. Or the stem of a flower, the stem, the stalk, or fresh broccoli.
Or when you just cut your backyard, the fresh grass. This is a fresh vegetal.
Okay.
Then you can have maybe a processed vegetal. For instance, when you boil your soup.
This can get complicated fast, can't it?
No easy.
So actually, the 9 family of odors are just the first layer of descriptors. Then you can go to a second or a third layer and going deeper into the definition, becoming more and more precise in assessment.
And that's your flavor wheel that you have in your book.
Yeah.
So I can see that from my limited experience doing this, I would need something on that tasting wheel to describe what that flavor really, or what that aroma really is, so that I have something to compare it to.
And we do that in the classroom. We have an exercise where we actually smell different little odors and we describe them. And this really solidifies in your brain what maybe rosemary should smell like, or maybe what a nut should smell like, or the skin of a nut. So this exercise is really great in the classroom to get people using their brain along with their nose and really start talking about honey or descriptors.
That experience would give me the memory I need to begin this process. I can see that. Now that to me would be very helpful, is to do what does vegetative smell like, and you hand me a bale of hay.
Exactly.
Okay, now I got it down. All
That's
right.
exactly Good. What we do. And this is how we teach people, by hands-on experience of smelling and tasting the different samples that we pass around.
Is floral the same in the U.S. as it is in Italy? Would both of you use the same word to describe honey?
Yes, we normally use rose, we use jasmine, we use those kind of fresh floral references. So I think the floral family is quite similar. Sometimes there might be some differences. For instance, we use citrus as aromatic. Sometimes in US, citrus is used as floral. Another thing that might complicate things a little bit more is that not every flower has a floral scent.
Yes, exactly. But if I know the one that I should be thinking of when I take that first breath, that's going to get me a long way in the right direction. So what you're saying is that there really isn't a cultural difference when it comes to tasting honey.
Yes. I mean, that our background is different, everybody. But those differences, for instance, even when I'm teaching in Italy, if I have a class in Milan or a class in Naples, people have different descriptors because they have different foods, they use different vegetals, they have a different background and traditions. So what is really helpful in doing this kind of exercise, you need to start smelling every day in your ordinary life, not only honeys. So everywhere you go, if you go for an haircut, if you go to fill the gasoil in your car, or if you go to your bee yard, pay attention to your nose and try to listen to your nose and pay attention, put some reference in your mind, try to describe them. So this is basically a lifestyle you should get into.
Do some people have a better sense of smell than others?
I mean, yes. There might be some physical differences. We normally say that youngsters are more, let's say, fresh in detecting the smells, and you lose some of your of your power during aging. Mm-hmm. But then you recover this, what you lose physically, you recover with experience. So you have more vocabulary, you have more memories, and then you can still perform even if, let's say, some buds are gone.
Yeah.
Well, maybe there's a chance for me yet then in learning some of this. Well, Marina, you've got a class coming up this fall where I can go and learn all of these things. How is your class going to work?
So we're in the process right now of planning. It's going to be a three-day course online. And basically, we're going to do somewhat of an abbreviated version of the in-classroom four-day program that we have been doing. Students can sign up on our website, theamericanhoneytastingsociety.com. And when it's not launched yet, but we plan on doing that soon, they can sign up and they will receive a kit in the mail, which will have all of the honey samples and the materials that they'll need to participate in those 3 days. And they can log in on, and we'll be teaching. It'll be me, Raffaele, and John Luigi, who's also based in Bologna. And the three of us will be running the class on Zoom.
So I'm going to get a bale of hay in this kit, right? So I know what...
We'll send you extra hay.
Okay, that's good. Well, Jeff, you'll have that contact information on our webpage.
You bet. And we'll have all this information in the show notes and the website. You bet.
Okay. All right. Well, we're about ready to wrap it up, but what did we miss? What's the biggest element of this that I didn't ask you about that's important?
I think we covered pretty much everything. We might talk a little bit about contests, the importance of contests, but we talked about that earlier, saying about the improvement of honey quality. What else?
Well, I really just wanted to add that basically you can learn to become a great taster. Nobody really walks into the classroom as an expert. Some people might have more sharper skills, but after the class and once you learn this method of tasting honey, you can go back and you can practice, you can self-train, and you can really become a better taster. The methods are very easy to learn, but they take some time to master, and you can practice at home. And I know for myself, since I took the first class in 2013, I've been working very hard and teaching and working with honey regularly almost every day. And I've seen quite an improvement, and it's possible for anybody to really become a very good taster.
I can confirm that also we had some wine sommelier attending our classes and also some olive oil assessors. And after they had experienced honey, they stated that honey was really opening their mind and helping them also to get some new descriptors to apply to wine or to olive oil as well. So I can confirm that.
Nothing against olive oil, but I would think after taking this course and all the varied tastes of honey, that going back to olive oil would be kind of, I don't want to say bland,
boring.
But yeah, boring. That's a good word.
Boring, yeah.
Well, you know, of course, it's, again, a single ingredient food, mm-hmm. honey. There are very different varieties of olive trees, and with respect to the climate, you get also a wide range of descriptors. What is most important with olive oil is the defective part. So you need to avoid the defect rather than, and of course, also to describe the aromas. But
well, this is really fascinating. Never really considered, I mean, I've considered the taste of honey, but I'm looking at the tasting wheel and all the different descriptors, and I'm thinking there's a whole world out there that I haven't explored yet. It's pretty fascinating.
And U.S. has a great potential. I think U.S. has a very great potential because you have large size crop field. You have a very different flora as well. So actually, I think U.S. Might be the next Italy with respect to the amount of single variety honey that you can produce?
Well, we've been trying to push varietals, honey varietals, for a very long time, I know. So this is pretty exciting. Adds more to that pursuit.
I'm going to add one more thing here, Jeff, before I forget it, is that one of the things that Marina wrote about in her book was you can grow a locust tree in Wisconsin and a locust tree in South Carolina, and the honey that comes from the same tree, the same variety of tree, will be different because of the environment that it grew up in, the weather that it experiences. And there's a word for that, Marina.
Terroir.
Terroir. So once you learn the taste of locust honey, then your next question is, okay, is this locust from Wisconsin or is this locust from South Carolina? And it gets even, there's another level there that you can learn. And I think I'm too old to learn all this anymore.
Well, we have a lot of work to do in the U.S. We do a lot of honey and we have a lot of honey to taste. And we've got to get all the beekeepers together to start exchanging and sharing information. And we'll all be better honey tasters.
Well, it sounds good. I'm going to start with your class, Marina. Jeff, are you going to join us?
When is it? Yes, it sounds really fascinating. I like I said, it's a whole new world that I hadn't really even peeked at. So I appreciate this opportunity this afternoon.
Yeah, it's been good. Folks, Raffaele and Marina, thank you very much. You've opened all of our eyes a little bit, and hopefully honey will start tasting better for us.
Thanks for having us.
If it doesn't start tasting better, at least we'll have better words to describe it. So that's...
There you go.
Exactly.
Better word to sell it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and look forward to having you back and to your course this fall.
Thank you.
You're most welcome. Right. Thank you.
Take care. Hey, Kim, thanks for bringing Marina back and Raffaele. It's what a great time for this show, too, with everyone pulling their honey harvest and getting a chance to taste their different honeys. This gives them a great way of doing it.
Yep, exactly. That's kind of why we shot for this time of year. But you know what interested me the most? Because I've worked with her for so long, I've heard parts of all of this before, not all of this, but the thing that I hadn't heard before, and it never dawned on me, that study that he did in Apomundia, where he took the same honey and crystallized it five different ways, and five different crystal sizes and thicknesses and whatever, and he had 100 people there. So we had a pretty good sample size, and you taste sample one, and you'd get a reaction that was good or bad, and sample two and all that. So you had five different crystals, same honey, five different responses. I know what I'm going to have to do now. I'm going to have to learn how to crystallize honey different ways so I can try that, because that to me was amazing.
Yeah, the crystallized honey or creamed honey is not a big thing in the States, or at least in pockets. You can find different people who like it, but it's not a big thing, as they were saying.
It's not. And when I make crystallized honey, I've got, believe it or not, maybe 10 years ago, I bought some Stoller's creamed honey off a grocery store shelf, and I still have it. and that's what I use for my starter. It was perfect then, and it's perfect now. But five different ways to cream honey. I'm amazed. The rest of it was good. What can go wrong with honey? You look at bubbles and foam and particulate matter and all of these things. And what you store it in. He mentioned a plastic pail, maybe taking on some flavor of the plastic. I've never experienced that, but now I'm going to have to go looking for it. Because who knows?
Yeah, there are a couple things there regarding the plastic. That's why I think it's important always to use food grade plastic, so you don't get any leak of flavors or any plastics or anything else from the bucket. The other thing was the discussion of even too much smoke when harvesting can affect the honey, and makes me wonder whether I should be using like cherry wood chips or mesquite or hickory chips in my smoker so I can get a little bit of...
There you go. Some infused honey.
Infused honey, yeah. Hey, anything to add a little pizzazz to the label.
There you go.
Okay, well, that about wraps it up for this podcast. Before we go, I want to encourage our listeners to rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, wherever you download and stream the show. Your vote helps other beekeepers find us quicker. Even better, write a review and let us know what you like, and we really appreciate those. There's some good reviews out there under Apple Podcasts. As always, we thank Bee Culture, the magazine for American beekeeping, for their continued support of Beekeeping Today podcast. We want to thank our regular episode sponsor, Global Patties. Check them out at www.globalpatties.com. We also want to thank Strong Microbials for becoming the latest supporter of the podcast. Check out their probiotic line at www.strongmicrobials.com. And finally, we want to thank you, the Beekeeping Today podcast listener, for joining us on this show. Feel free to send us questions and comments at questions@beekeepingtodaypodcast.com. We'd love to hear from you. Anything else, Kim?
Well, you know, you mentioned those questions and comments. We've been getting quite a few, and we appreciate the interaction with the people who listen, and keep it up.
Please do. Thanks a lot.